Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. You'd have to be of a certain age to understand today's program title. Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, is calling this particular show, McCarthyism Lives On. Lincoln, some of our younger listeners may be scratching their heads and saying, who? Maybe you should explain.
Well, you've also flushed me out. I'm not of a certain age.
Well, okay.
Close, but yeah. Not quite. Yeah. The whole McCarthy story was played out in the early 50s when I was alive, but barely then. So I have no personal memory of the McCarthy era. But it's coming back to haunt us in the United States for a number of reasons, which I hope I can get to in 15 minutes. But yes, it's worth remembering what happened. It was right after World War II when the Soviet Union essentially was the winner in World War II. I mean, we threw our lot in, but the majority of the dying and the size of the military belonged to the Soviet Union. You have to face that. And that's why they swept in and took over most of Germany and the so-called satellite countries of Eastern Europe were firmly under their control. And the U.S. was freaked about this takeover by a communist power. And, of course, capitalism sees communism as its deadly enemy. And as a Christian, I don't much like communism at all. And as a Christian also, I'm not overly impressed with unbounded capitalism, which is, if you really analyze it the way it's expressed, it's Darwinism writ into the economic system, the survival of the fittest. Yes. But it was a great clash of the isms. And the U.S. was so afraid of the rising power of Russia that basically that's what tipped the scales in deciding the U.S. deciding to use the nuclear bomb on Japan, which was already fading, but it was to warn the Soviet Union. And so in the years that followed, there was great paranoia about this red takeover of the world, the dominoes falling and so on. And the paranoia that developed in the U.S. was about spies and so on. And in 1951, and believe me, I was barely alive in 1951. In 1951, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, husband and wife team, were identified as spying on the Manhattan Project for the atomic bomb. They were brought to trial and executed.
Yes.
And that started a chain of circumstances that involved a couple of key characters, Senator McCarthy, his legal counsel, Roy Cohn, and continuing House Un-American Activities hearings that the senator called, where this paranoia became a vehicle for both of them to really have leverage over not just the other party, but even over President Eisenhower as he took office. It was amazing. And public figure after public figure was brought in and accused of being a communist spy. The charge early on was that it was the State Department that was full of spies. And there was, other than the Rosenberg thing, which preceded it by a year or two, there was no evidence that any of them were spies whatsoever. It was just the accusation. And what gave them some power is in their youth, many of these public figures had briefly belonged to the Communist Party, which was an ism growing at the time.
Yeah.
Then they moved on and they were not active communists or interested in it, but this ghost was brought up and then they were asked to name all of their friends and turn everybody in. And it reached such a pitch that at one point, Senator McCarthy with his offsider Roy Cohn went into U.S. public libraries and libraries in government offices and looked for books that were written by people that they felt had the taint of communism. The book could be nothing to do with communism whatsoever. And authors like Langston Hughes and others were brought in to account for their deviant thoughts, and their books were burned. You think it just happened in the Middle Ages. And the fear was palpable through Washington. And Roy Cohn, who in his later life was described as one of the most evil men in America, used heavy-handed tactics of threat and intimidation to cow any number of public leaders. And it didn't really end until Roy Cohn and Senator McCarthy took on the U.S. military. They claimed that there were spies in the military and the high command. And the only thing that sort of gave pause to this dangerous duo was that a young propagandist who had been brought in to the McCarthy camp was drafted into the military in 1953. His name was Shine. And he went into the military. And it appears that Roy Cohn was more than just a friend with him. And he badgered the military endlessly to give special treatment to Shine, which they did, because they were afraid of Roy Cohn and McCarthy. And when the army was really on the ropes, and then the president decided that he'd had enough of it, then they brought a hearing against McCarthy, and it came out that there was probably something funny between Roy Cohn and this Shine. But along the line, Roy Cohn had threatened that he would wreck the army. He threatened them big time. They would wreck the army if they didn't help this David Shine that was his friend. And in a classic scene, the attorney for the military in public, he asked if a photo that they presented as evidence had come from some pixie. And they said, "What's a pixie?" He says, "Oh, that's a relative to a fairy." All right. Now, I'm bringing this up for a reason, because what McCarthy traded on more than anything else was that there was a lavender scare in the U.S., that homosexuality in the military and in the government exposed these people to blackmail, and that they would more easily be made Soviet spies than anyone else. So they were also hunting down moral degenerates, according to the thinking of the age, and certainly according to biblical morality. But they were hunting these people down. And the supreme irony was that Roy Cohn was as outrageously involved in that area as anybody ever could be. He died of AIDS in 1986. And there's lessons to be gained from it. They were quoting God and country regularly, using immorality as a tool, but they themselves were not moral. They were burning books, so they were against ideas, and patriotism had become an evil weapon to wield against someone, that even to invoke the fifth, where you wouldn't speak, according to the Constitution, or right against self-incrimination, that would ruin you if you said you couldn't say anything because you didn't want to incriminate yourself or others. You were finished. Lives were ruined over this.
Well, okay. How does that fold over in today?
Well, it folds over, and I've mentioned it before on this program. Roy Cohn did not go away. He became a power broker par excellence. He helped put Reagan into office. In fact, a witness said that they were there when Reagan's wife called to thank him for getting her husband elected. Wow. He defended Gotti, the underworld character who shot someone, and he got him off. But before he died, he linked up with a number of New York tycoons, in particular, our present president. And on the day President Trump was elected, he was heard to say, "I wish Roy were here to see this." And I wouldn't begin to try to link our president, we'd be wrong, with all of Roy's goings on. But what is absolutely certain, the techniques that were perfected then are still being used. The techniques of wild attacks on people to destroy their credibility, and the technique of just not respecting the law and just fight, fight, fight. And it worries me the most of anything that's going on. It's a devolution of the public morality. And let's allow for a minute what is obvious, not the Christian nation concept, but we are the inheritors of an Anglo-Saxon, Judeo-Christian public morality. And that is being frittered away, not even frittered, it's being devolving at the speed of light. And out of that may well come book burnings, moral marginalization, and use even of religion to make someone a second or a third class citizen.
Link, Lincoln, I got to ask you this. Your office is located, you know, just outside the Beltway of Washington, D.C. You go often into the city. What is going? Is there something in the air down there? Is there something in the water in that town that takes the elected officials that we, the people, have chosen with our consciences clear and by doing our due diligence to figure out who to vote for, we put them in this sandbox called Washington, D.C., and then that happens. Why does that happen, Lincoln? Why?
Well, I'm a bit of a contrarian, so I have to say that there are some wonderful public officials elected and appointed, and I believe are doing their level best to uphold the public good. Mm-hmm. But we're in a dangerous time when people of an exploitive nature have moved in, and the checks and balances are not there like they used to be.
Yes, right.
Even within our own church, and I don't want to elaborate on it too much, I've thought about this. You know, we have church policy, mm-hmm. but policy is hard to enforce. Things work better when you had people that had an inner compass to do the right thing, and it's the same in government. Even most famously now, impeachment. Impeachment's not going to work unless you have the process is not going to work unless you have a broad spectrum of legislators who are committed to the public good. If they're partisan and determined to push something through regardless, the whole system becomes defunct. And we need to pray for our leaders, certainly in the church, but we need to pray for our civil leaders. Not that God will work through everything, but that their spirits will be softened down where they can look to the public good. They can do the right thing.
So the policies that we make and the laws that we make and the principles that we don't abide by only work on people who have hearts that are open to those things. If you don't have a heart that's open to it, it's not going to work.
They're very similar things in more secular language. Democracy depends on a moral and an educated constituency. Mm-hmm. If you have people that are determined to live above the law, the Constitution can't save you. I'm aghast lately at some of the things going on when, I don't claim to be a constitutional scholar, but I read it from time to time, and I'm telling you, the simplest reading of it would put much of what happens at odds with the plainest statements of the Constitution. Yes, yeah. So the mere fact that it's written down does very little good to us unless there's a compass, an inbuilt compass in people to hark back to the law and abide by it.
All right. We need to be praying for that compass, not only in our own hearts, but in our leaders' hearts and in our country's hearts as well. LibertyMagazine.org is the website, and Lincoln Steeves is its editor and has been our guest today. Lincoln, thank you so much for your words of wisdom.
My pleasure.
And listener, until next time, this is Charles Mills, along with Lincoln Steeves, inviting you to rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone. If you'd like more information about LifeQuest Liberty, call 443-391-7258 or email us through our website at libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of liberty burning in your heart today.